This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is Friday, and usually that means we kick off the program with our Week in Review panel. But today, we are very happy to welcome Boston Mayor Marty Walsh to the program to talk about the big stories of the week about City Hall and to take your calls.
So if you have questions for the mayor about the Boston Marathon, the bombing trial, the city's Olympic bid, about his push for more diversity in City Hall, anything at all, give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Mayor Walsh, it's great to have you in on the program. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here today.
It's really good to have you. So let's start with your reaction to the letter on the front page of today's Boston Globe from the Richard family, the parents of Martin Richard, who was killed in the Boston Marathon bombing, and of course of Jane Richard, who lost a leg. They say to end the anguish of reliving these events through years and years of death penalty appeals, the feds should drop their pursuit of the death penalty and settle for life in prison. What do you think? What's your reaction?
Well, I first, Bill and Denise, I commend them for really their first public display here in 2 years. They certainly suffered an awful lot in the tragedy of Marathon Monday. They lost their son, Martin. Their daughter lost her leg. And they had other issues in the family in results of the bombing. I commend them for their courage for putting this letter in the paper. I commend them. I think they thought of every single word that went in this article and how they were feeling. I think Bill Richards, it says at the very end that he just wants this behind them. Mm-hmm. He wants to be able to try and move on and his family move on. And I think that's the feeling of probably every, not necessarily about the death penalty, but every single survivor wants this trial moved on. You know, 1 year ago, we had the anniversary, and it was very fresh in people's minds. And 1 year later, we had another second anniversary. And in the middle of the second anniversary, we had the first phase of the trial, and then the next phase is the sentencing. So
It's a compelling argument, especially coming from this family. But what do you think about the argument in and of itself?
Well, you know, I have not given my opinion on what should happen here, and I'm going to hold my opinion till after the jury makes their decision. You know, as a legislator, I voted against that penalty.
So can I ask you why? I mean, I want to understand. I understand that you're opposed to the death penalty. So why not just come out and say, yeah, it would be better not to pursue the death penalty in this trial?
Because it's not my place. It's not my place to do that. You know, I don't think I should be showboating here and telling how I feel. I think you have to let the jury make the determination. If the survivors and families who lost loved ones want to make determinations like Bill did today, that's perfectly fine. They're entitled to that, and they should do that if they choose. But I think as an elected official, I've been pretty consistent on this. I've really not commented on the trial at all, other than very briefly. I don't feel it's my place to do that.
Meghna.
Well, since we are talking about, of course, events surrounding the marathon, on Wednesday it was the 2-year anniversary of the bombing, and you observed a moment of silence at City Hall. Can you just tell us sort of what the day was like for you?
Well, I'll tell you, one Boston day, which we had, was an incredible day. It started in the morning, and I was with the Richard family and the Campbell family and the Collier family earlier in the day, and then I was at the site of the Old Forum restaurant where the first bomb went off, and we recognized a moment of silence there, and we unveiled the banner. After that, went over to the library with the families and had a chance to meet with the survivors, and it was a bit of a reunion. I got to tell you, last year, leading up to the marathon, the anniversary was a very somber moment, and then you know, but meeting the survivors, they're incredible people. And then I went to Spalding Rehab, went to Engine 33 on Boylston Street. I went to D4 Police Station, and we went to the Sheridan for a blood drive. And it was an inspirational day. It was a draining day. Mm-hmm. I was exhausted at the end of the day, and not physically, just mentally. And the moment of silence at City Hall was incredible. You know, thousands of people came out of City Hall, and people, the construction across the street stopped, and the bells rang, and we had a moment of silence. And Father Sean Connor happened to be there, so impromptu he said a prayer for everybody. And the Richard family was with me, and it was just an incredible day. And just hearing the stories of what went on around Boston, around Massachusetts, actually really around America. The president tweeted about it, and the vice president tweeted about it. And on Twitter, if that's a benchmark, it was the number one story for a lot of the day. And it's incredible how you take a tragedy 2 years before and you turn it into something positive. And I think that's important for us to do. We do it as Bostonians, we do it as Americans, and our response is not necessarily, and there is anger, don't get me wrong, but doing something kind for people.
Yeah, so, you know, Anthony had a really interesting conversation with Dan Donahue, who is the general manager of the Lenox Hotel. And one of the things that he told Anthony was that, yeah, it's been 2 years, and of course this week it's all in the forefront of our minds, but that that this event doesn't define us. It doesn't define the city.
Absolutely not. And Dan Donahue and Lenox Hotel is an incredible partner here in the city. And so many different, you know, our Veterans Affairs office went out and planted flags. Our kindergartners at the Elliott School in the North End went and made cards and brought them to the firefighters. I heard other stories of people doing acts of kindness. It was just incredible. One of the things that really struck me the most was later in the afternoon, I was at the Reggie Lewis Track Center, and a mother came up to me, and she said to me, "My son wanted to tell you, Mayor, to let the Richard family know that I had a moment of silence today for their son." 11-year-old boy on his own went to his mother to say that. And you think about the impact that this had in people's lives, including an 11-year-old. You know, the Red Sox stopped the ball game and had a moment of silence. There was so many great acts of kindness in this city. And it just shows you that we are a great city. And it shows you, really, I think, you know, the survivor community here around the marathon, you know, I can't express it in words how incredible they are. And you know something? Some of them are still very hurt.
Right.
And going through a lot, and they put up a strong front for all of us. But my heart and prayers go out to them, and they should, from everybody in Boston and in America, for those families every single day. Very similar to families who lost loved ones on 9/11.
So, Mayor Welch, let me ask you, I mean, absolutely it doesn't define the city, but there are still obviously reverberations from what happened 2 years ago, because they're, you know, in security briefings for this year's marathon. We had a report from WBUR reporter Kurt Nickish this morning, who told listeners that the police department isn't saying how many cameras or surveillance cameras are going up along the route, the marathon route, nor how many of them were going to stay up permanently after the marathon. So, I mean, it does kind of raise some questions about civil liberties, privacy concerns, that kind of thing.
I mean, unfortunately, things are changing in the world for us, and that day changed a lot of things in Boston for us. There are more cameras going up. It's in 2004, when we had the Democratic National Convention here, cameras kind of went up on poles and was kind of new for us. If there weren't cameras up, we wouldn't have caught these two, as quick as they did. But there is questions around civil liberties, and I'm certainly, as a state representative, I voted against a lot of legislation with cameras and intersections catching drivers. I mean, I voted against it. You have to balance it with public safety too. And I think, you know, as far as security for the marathon, last year we had very strong, strict security, but everyone enjoyed the day. I think that we have the same type of security this year at the marathon. We're going to have undercover police. We're not going to have a militarization of Boylston Street. We didn't do it last year, but we are going to have security out there. I think when you see the Red Sox, Fenway Park, install metal detectors, That shows you society's changing, and it's sad because
it's a new day.
You know, it is a new day, because growing up, we weren't worried about that. I remember having a conversation with my cousins in England that we're talking about, you know, kind of how we're changing here, and they're used to living like that because there was always something happening in England, and it was a way of life for them here. We're not used to that way of life here in Boston.
Listeners, we're talking to Mayor Marty Walsh for the first 30 minutes or so of this program. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you've got questions for the mayor, give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. Mr. Mayor, let's move on to another big issue facing the city, and that is the push to host the 2024 Olympics. You're a big supporter of the city's Olympic bid. As you know, there's still a lot of opposition here to the idea. Our polling has shown that, though the most recent WBUR poll suggests that support for the Games is rising somewhat. So here's a Mass Inc. pollster, Steve Cozella.
The bleeding has stopped. From January to February, and then from February to March, we saw a drop in support each month and a climb in the number of people opposing the Boston Olympics. That's stopped now this month. This month, we see 40% saying they would support the idea and 50% opposing.
So still 50% opposing. What do you need to do to make the case?
I think he mentioned the bleeding has stopped, and I think the bleeding was self-inflicted with the joiner agreement, the kind of the pushback on the ballot. ballot initiative, the releasing of the salaries, and I think that clouded the conversation around the Olympics here in the city of Boston for a good 6 weeks, 6-8 weeks. Now, really, why I support the Olympics and what I support the Olympics from the very beginning is there's an opportunity for us to have a conversation, not just here in Boston, but on a world stage, about the strengths of our city. There's an opportunity to talk about the opportunities of growth in our city by using the Olympics as a catalyst. You know, the concern still is going to be around the cost, potential cost overruns, and what the cost of the venues are, and those questions have to be answered by folks. My office, we made some moves today. We established the Office of Olympic Planning, and we appointed an executive director, Sarah Meyerson, who's going to be working with 2024 and with the United States Olympic Committee on discussions around the 2024 Olympics and the Paralympic Games. She certainly has incredible experience, background in affordable housing, financing. So she has a good, well-rounded resume.
And what's going to be her brief? What's she going to do?
She's really going to be looking at and checking over any documents that the city is going to be signing, but really ultimately analyzing the economic analyst mitigation, public health, safety studies, transportation planning, really looking at all of those pieces.
And Mr. Mayor, though, I mean, we just got a tweet from James Donner who's asking, if no taxpayer money is involved, why did we just spend $115,000 on an analyst for the Olympic Games no one wants? That's nice. What James Donner said.
Thanks, James. James is quick with the tweets. Thank you, James. That was really fast. Well, we're going to be billing back to 2024 to pay for her salary. She's working for the city, but we're going to be billing back any hours, almost like a billable hour type situation. So it won't be taxpayers' dollars, and we're very careful about that. And we had a lot of discussion about how we should proceed with Sarah's salary, and we thought at one point maybe putting her on the payroll in the city. But then we also felt that, you know, what I've said, so we're going to bill back the hours.
Let's take a call. Seth is calling from Jamaica Plain. Mr. Mayor, Seth's got a question about the Olympics. Seth, you're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Mayor.
Hi, so Seth.
First of all, I'm still deeply troubled with how public concerns over the potential Boston 2024 Olympics have been addressed or not addressed. I think it's better late than never for you to establish this Office of Olympic Planning. And for the sake of trust and transparency, will any analysis or reports produced by this office be made public, either by the office or via Freedom of Information Act requests?
Yeah, well, the beauty for Sarah is she's a public employee, so there is a Freedom of Information Act that everything she does is public. And I think you're absolutely right. I don't think it's late. We're still early in the bid, and I think one of the things that is missing here is the fact that we're not truly having a discussion around the Olympics and what the cost might be and to get that information out to the public. So I agree with you on that, and it's something that Sarah is going to be tasked with. We've kicked around the idea of putting up a webpage and our own city webpage to talk about all these different things. And I think as we move forward, the negative conversations and the people that are concerned about the Olympics, I don't know if we've been able to get a full explanation out of what the Olympics actually mean. And I think that, from the beginning, the conversations kind of went everything but the Olympic conversation or everything around the Olympic conversation. I think that we need an opportunity here to explain why I support the Olympics. Again, I don't support the Olympics to leave my legacy with a bill that future mayors and future taxpayers are going to pay.
Well, let me ask you about that bill, because we've spoken a lot to Andrew Zimbalist, a Smith College economist, on this issue. And as you know, he's an Olympic skeptic. He wrote this morning in the Globe that the history of the Olympics shows that countries that host them lose money. And he says claims that American cities that have hosted them actually earned a surplus were based on faulty accounting and didn't take into account things like subsidies and other stuff. Are you confident that if Boston wins the bid, taxpayers really won't be left holding?
That's his spin on it. And I think if you look at Barcelona as a company country that's not United States, you see the long-lasting legacy that's been very successful in Barcelona. Some of the greatest beaches in the world. The tourism is up. Everything seems to be working well there. Atlanta comes to the United States. Atlanta is a city where Olympic Village is a catalyst for.
Do you think too many of Bostonians are just too curmudgeonly about this?
I don't know if it's curmudgeon. I think Bostonians are tough. I mean, we question everything,
right?
And then after we get the answer, we question it again. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, but I think the fact that coming out not ever finding a positive, there has to be something that Olympics have done. I mean, New York City won for the Olympic bid; they didn't get it. What's happening? There's expansion in Brooklyn, New York, right now. That's happening. 1.3 square miles of waterfronts being developed directly. Result, and they'll say it, of going after Olympic bid. Chicago didn't get the Olympics. They went after it. What happened there? Tourism went up. Convention center business went up. Directly a result of hosting the Olympic bid. Los Angeles, with his legacy, the $100 million, he questioning the money. Go follow the money, and it'll tell you the story. Utah was able to work an infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, connecting roadways and mountains with the Olympic bid. I mean, yeah, people are going to talk about Sochi. That's not a fair comparison. That's just not a fair comparison. And one thing that I think that's very different here that's not explained is when the United States goes for a bid, it's privately funded with the exception of security and infrastructure money. When other countries go for a bid, it's predominantly funded by governments. And that's when you get into these bidding wars where there's kind of no price tag that they don't go after. So I think it's a very different game. We're talking about bringing a game to Boston that's very economical, that's probably going to be the most inexpensive games ever delivered in the history of Olympics because of the IOC, International Olympic Committee, realized that they had a problem.
But Mr. Mayor, I'm looking at Andrew Zimbalist's piece in the Globe today, and he said that reported surpluses from the games operations depended on significant public subsidies. I mean, he was looking at Salt Lake City and Atlanta, $600 million in the cases of Atlanta and $1.3 billion in the case of Salt Lake City. And then he says, if Boston 2024 really wants this to work, there's one way to prove it. It can release both the city and the state from the financial backstop role and accept full responsibility for all shortfalls, overruns, or losses.
I don't know. First of all, we're planning on working on that. We did it in the first round. We took the $25 million that was in the document that if we pulled out of the bid or 2024 pulled out of the bid, we'd owe the United States Olympic Committee $25 million. We took an insurance policy out to cover that money. In Chicago, part of their bid had an insurance policy that covered overruns of the tune of $1 billion or so. Again, we're looking at all of these, and Sarah is going to be tasked with looking at how do we make sure the city's protected when it comes to infrastructure money. And people might, Andrew, I think Andrew's against infrastructure money as well. Infrastructure money helps not just for the 2 weeks the Olympics are here, but it's long standing before and after the Olympics. The infrastructure improvements are important. MBTA, example. For 17 years now, I was a legislator 17 years ago, we voted to reform the MBTA. We clearly didn't get it to a 21st century transit system yet. In 2010, there was another reform effort. Still didn't get there. This gives us a date certain that we have to get the structure, the MBTA, up and running in a proper way. Sometimes you need that end date, and I think the Olympics can be used as a catalyst on a whole host of different issues, different projects.
Mr. Mayor, let's go to Angela, who's calling from Bay Village. She's got a question about the Olympics. And listeners, if you want to join this conversation, 800-423-8255 to join the talk with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. Angela from Bay Village, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Hi, Mr. Mayor.
Hi, Angela.
Great to hear you.
Thank you.
I know you care about us as people, and that's why I picked up the phone, the first time in history I've ever done such a thing.
I love it. Thank you.
I want to say that I'm a middle-class school teacher. I pay to live in my home in the city of Boston, where we've lived since 34 years. I pay $14,000 in taxes. I would like you to tell me who, as people, are going to benefit. Is the middle class and the working poor going to benefit from the Olympics coming?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I think that benefits is first of all, the entire city of Boston. And one of the legacies that came out of the Olympic bid in New York that didn't happen in Industry Village in New York City, there are manufacturing facilities there that pay middle class wages for folks that don't have college degrees in education. There are thousands of people working there today in manufacturing plants that weren't there prior to the Olympic conversation. And I think as what I'm talking about, and I'm actually chairing the Inequality Task Force for the United States Conference of Mayors to really focus on the middle class and the poor and the working poor to help pull those folks up from where they are. And I think that this conversation around the Olympics will be able to help us with that. Again, forget the games. Having the conversation about the Olympics allows us to go around to 110 different countries around the world and market the city of Boston for zero. And that's the that's one of the benefits. And the long-standing benefit is if we get the Olympics, what's the legacy factor for the city of Boston to be able to promote Boston as an Olympic city?
But again, just participating in the marketing of Boston,
that's what I think
is a huge benefit.
I think that's one of the biggest benefits. And whether or not we get the bid in 2017, We're going around to 110 different countries around the world talking about the strengths of our city. And I think that that alone, forget the Olympics and the Paralympic Games, bring them here. That alone, that conversation allows us to go out. Why are we going to those countries? To talk about the strengths of our city.
Right.
And that's something that, I think is the benefit here. And that I think has not been explained, probably not by me or anybody. And we got to explain that more.
So Jonathan Cohn is tweeting us. You can kind of get a sense of which way the tweets are tilting. Okay.
Oh, yes, I hear that. That's fine.
But he says, ask Mayor Walsh why he doesn't think he has to show up for his own Olympic community meeting.
Well, that's not true, Jonathan. I've been to two out of there's been three meetings. I've shown up for two. And I missed the last one, and I have to miss the next one. I'll be at the rest of them. I mean, my schedule, unfortunately, we booked these meetings out, and I couldn't make the last meeting, and I won't be able to make the next meeting, but I missed the meeting in Brighton. I'm going to miss the meeting in Roxbury, and I was at the meeting in South Boston. I was at the meeting in Suffolk University, so I'll be there. But my John Fitzgerald from the BRA is there, and I have people from the staff there taking notes and working on it. So that's why I missed the meeting.
All right. So you mentioned infrastructure. So can we talk about my favorite topic?
Yes.
It's the T.
MBTA.
The topic I love to hate. No, not really. I have lived car free around here for 16 years because of the MBTA.
Magno's a transportation geek.
So let me ask you.
Well, I love it. I mean, I love it. The T. I mean,
what I wanted to ask you was, obviously Governor Baker's panel came out with its big report, yep. Right? And one of the things was that they called for was a financial control and oversight board.
Yep.
The governor says he wants to do that, but just this week we're seeing pushback from the MBTA board and the current interim general manager saying that's not going to help.
I think the way you fix the MBTA and one of the reports they talked about is understanding the money and getting the money under control, and then coming up with a plan, a phased-in plan on how you upgrade the service. When I say upgrade the service, I don't simply mean buy new cars. I'm talking about upgrade the infrastructure of the T. And it has to be phased-in approach, because I think if somebody gave the governor probably, I don't know what the cost would be, billions and billions of dollars to upgrade all at one point, you could get it done. But you have to understand where the money's coming. It's like a house budget. If you want to fix your home, you have to understand what your finances are first. Once you get your finances under control, then you can talk about fixing the bathroom, fixing the bedroom, putting new windows on, painting the outside, and doing all the things you want. And then eventually you get to the landscaping.
So it sounds like riders are going to have to pay more eventually. So, that's what the report
says. The report opens up for the ability to put in a fare increase. The one thing that I think is very unfortunate here with the timing of the MBTA, if this situation happened 6 months beforehand, the voters of Massachusetts voted down a ballot initiative indexing the gas tax. All of that money was going to transportation infrastructure. That was a big chunk, and I was in the legislature when we voted on that. That was money that was earmarked towards transportation only. It was worth about $500 million per year. It was a large amount of money to be able to do some infrastructure. When the voters repealed that, that's a chunk of money that you don't have now. And right now we have a pretty good economy, but if we have a down economy, I mean, you're never going to get ahead. And you have to come up with a funding source. And I honestly don't think that fare increases are going to pay for the upgrades that are needed on the T. They're too big. So I think there has to be some So I think the first thing the governor said, get the financing under control. I agree with that. And then once you get the financing under control, you move to the next steps.
So we've got a call. Let's go to Samuel from Shirley, who wants to ask you about a different issue, Mr. Mayor. Samuel, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. And also, thank you very much for your service.
Thank you, Samuel.
With relation to diversity in city council, I was wondering where you would stand on if you could have more diversity but they were less qualified, or if you could have a city council with less diversity but better qualifications, which one you would choose and why?
I don't know if I can answer that question. I mean, the city council is where the voters make that call, And I'm not dodging the question, although I might sound like I am. I'm going to leave that to the voters to decide. But I can tell you what we're doing in our office. We just did a report, a diversity report in city governments. All our department heads, all our cabinet, and the rank-and-file city employees. And for the first time ever, we created a chief diversity officer and a deputy chief diversity officer in our city. And we're going to generate reports and actually work with managers and work with department heads and work with cabinet chiefs on how to truly diversify the city of Boston and both full and part-time employees. If you look at the numbers of the city, it tells a pretty, for women, it tells a pretty good story. if you take out the school department of that total number, our number for women in city government, I believe, goes from somewhere like 54% women down to 28% women when it's non-school. So we have some work to do in our own area. I'm going to let the voters decide how they want to diversify the city council. But as mayor of the city of Boston, I'm going to work really hard to make sure that the city hall, not mine, city hall reflects the people of Boston. My cabinet is 50% people of color. My command staff and the police department is 50% people of color. First time in the history of Boston, both of those numbers are 50% people of color. As we go further into the organization, the numbers aren't as good, but my goal is to make sure we improve those numbers. And Sean Blue, who's the chief diversity officer, Frieda Bransfield, who's the deputy, are going to be working through all across city government. And in this year's budget, we put some money in the budget this year, first time ever, for a diversity officer inside the Boston Fire Department. So we're really working on different areas to make sure we have pathways into city government.
So you mentioned women, and you've taken some big steps in terms of closing the gender wage gap, even on your own cabinet. But the Boston Globe reported that even after certain raises, on average, women still make $27,000 less on average than the men in your cabinet.
Yeah, we still have some work to do. I mean, again, it's budget issues, and I can't, you know... If I raise
where's your magic wand,
if I raise
Mr.
it
Mayor?
All, I'd be in the story for giving out raises. No, but we'll work. I mean, we're working on it. Again, we have work to do. I'm not saying that we don't have work to do. And some of these salaries have been set historically, and it's something that we're working towards. And you know, every single year we move forward, I'm going to improve. When I first got in office, the challenge was making sure the cabinet was 50% people of color, making sure the police department reflected the community. We were able to hit some of the benchmarks, not all the way. As we move forward with this report and with the salaries, we're realizing we have work to do, and it's something that before I go out and start challenging industry, which I am to some degree, I have to make sure that my industry, the building I work in, is living up to what we're talking about.
All right. Well, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, thanks so much for coming in. We're really, really grateful to have you. Come back and see us again soon, please.
I'd love to. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Mayor. Well, coming up, WBUR's Alex Ashlock joins us for a look ahead to Monday's marathon. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
Yeah.